program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. In honor of our 30th year on air, I've invited four of my very favorite poets to share this hour. Four women poets from Washington, D.C., each one very different, each one making a huge mark in the sky. And the first up is Barbara Goldberg. Known her a long time and you will love her. Here she is.
Aluminum. My father loved whatever was new, like the aluminum pan he brought home one night, dangling it by its ring from his pinky. "Look how light it is," he crowed, glancing with scorn at the cast iron skillet. He never stepped into the kitchen, yet there he was, in a merry mood, frying up bacon. My sister and I were enchanted, perched on red leatherette chairs, swinging our legs. Soon the strips, pale and pink as the skin under a scab, were trembling in a pool of grease. Then my father swirled the pan so the bacon wouldn't stick, spilling fat onto the burner. That's how light it was, the pan. Flames shot up to the ceiling. It stayed black until the painters came. I don't remember who cleaned up the mess, only that he didn't lose his temper at me for being a chatterbox, or my sister for chewing her braids. And he didn't hit us either. Even he couldn't blame the pan, only the hand that held it.
That's the voice of Barbara Goldberg. She just won the Felix Pollack Poetry Prize for a new book, The Royal Baker's Daughter. That's coming from the University of Wisconsin. And she's had three other books, Marvelous Pursuits, which won another national award, the Violet Reed Haas Prize. She translated The Fire Stays in Red, poems by Ronnie Samick.
That's right.
And edited After the First Rain, Israeli Poems on War and Peace. She has been produced all over the country, and today she's ours. Barbara, if you were one of the judges of the Felix Pollack Prize, what do you think made them choose your manuscript? What did they like?
Well, that's an interesting question, since I've been thinking about that a lot. And having judged several, you know, prizes myself, I know that when it gets down to like the last three to five, it really could be any of them. And so I just count myself among the very, very blessed. The poet who selected me would not have been one I would have guessed would have been
who was
attuned
the judge?
To my work, David St. John.
Oh, he's a wonderful poet.
Yes. So I'm not really sure. I have four sections to the book, and each section is very, very different. So maybe there was one that just kind of hit his fancy.
This is Barbara Goldberg. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and she's going to go on.
This is the title poem of the book, which is called The Royal Baker's Daughter. The Day Before. The day before the war, I dreamt you left me for another woman, a native of your homeland, who grew up singing the same silly songs. Even in my dream, I knew you loved me still. But this was different, like that time in Charlottesville, when we were guests, pretending you were king, and I, the royal baker's daughter. The day before the war, you dreamt that I was young again, black bangs down to my eyebrows, my breasts pert and impudent. It was fall, and you weren't limping yet. Could have danced the foxtrot, had you so wished. We were walking hand in hand, the leaves already turned a fiery red. The day the war broke out, the TV switched its focus, showed us billowing yellow clouds and visions in green. It wasn't yet a week before we learned that our supply lines were too thin and we didn't have sufficient troops on the ground. This wouldn't be the first time there were such miscalculations. Take you and me, the years rolling over us like water and us choking on the dreams we once dreamed while awake.
Let's have another, because I would like them to get a full spectrum. Each one of your poems is so different from the other.
I think I might read a sort of a political poem in a way, and it's called From the Book of Judges. Once a Jew was defined as someone who always carried a suitcase, his legacy a book, and the clothes on his back. And once this land was defined as a promise of milk, a promise of honey. Now half-brothers fight for a dunam of earth, a ceiling to count on. Now this land is a promise gone haywire, a daredevil's mishap. Go out in the street and play Russian roulette. Go out to a club and find fresh young bodies blown to bits, their garments still sparkling. Now the forest is burning. Charred skeletons of trees provide neither food nor shelter. Goats grind their teeth on whatever grows. Now the camera freezes on demonstrators from both sides, wearing baseball caps and faded T-shirts, as though fitted by the same tailor in a uniform of rage. Once these heights were volcanic, the basalt rock remains look like ground pepper or stubble on a cheek. How to survive this place where blood feuds last for eons, where sticks and stones and absolutes reign, and nothing, even sin, is original.
Oh, was that in the new manuscript?
Yes, it is.
I know why it won. That it went on that poem. That is one of the best poems you've ever written, and know it. It has all.
I'm in love with the different ones at different times.
Howard Nemiroff said, "All of our children."
Yeah.
Let's have a different one. Barbara Goldberg is here at the Library of Congress. We're celebrating her Felix Pollack Award.
Well, I might as well do something delicious. And this is called The Gourmand's Prayer. Yellowtail snapper with citrus beurre blanc, roast duck garnished with mint jellied peaches, angels on horseback, dates stuffed with garlic cloves wrapped in bacon, dipped in a hot honey pepper sauce, bananas Foster, key lime pie, raspberry mousse, Lord, grant me the power to well digest all that I have well eaten.
She is a fiction writer, feature writer, and a speech writer for a large national organization, and yet finds time. This is your soul's work.
Yes, it is.
How much time do you give it?
Well, that's a difficult question. It's very hard to maintain a double life, no matter what kind of double life that you try to maintain. Yet, I think it's an interesting way to live, and it provides you with more options, maybe. So, these poems come a lot of times in bits and scraps. I wish I could say I got up early in the morning and just wrote away, but I don't.
You work hard.
Yeah, well.
So you work hard. You revise and revise.
That's true.
I know you will. Let's have another.
Well, I'll read a poem about my work as a speechwriter, and it's called Headquarters. I have been sitting in this chair, this office, this room with a window that doesn't open so long I fear I've lost the art of breathing. My task is to draft speeches for powerful people that must pass through the eyes of a man scared of losing his job. The trick is to write in his style so he can get the credit. In this way, I become indispensable. Strange how common ghosting is. Today, I heard my own words coming from the chief of staff, exhorting us to soften the environment for brand acceptance. Bombard it with the message that this association is new and innovative, helping people over 50 enjoy life. I am over 50 and not enjoying life. Perhaps because I've strayed from my own nature. Traditore, traitor, doctor of spin, me whose aim is clarity, telling it slant. Sometimes I almost feel at home here, and here is East of Eden. Downtown on the Red Line, well-fed, well-groomed, making a killing in the land of Nod.
Oh.
I have to say a word about land of Nod. I've asked many people what they think the land of Nod is, and they seem to respond by saying blinkin', winkin', and Nod. But actually, Nod is where Cain was exiled from the Garden of Eden. And so the land of Nod is...
Your cubicle.
Is it right? Right.
But you know, this is why you're winning all these national awards, because, see, the universe is very fair, and you do things you don't get credit for. And other people get the credit. And so there's a spiritual ledger. And on the other side of the page, they say, Barbara deserves credit.
Oh, that's a lovely way to think of it.
Well, or else you could just be a good poet. Let's have another. Barbara Goldberg at the Library of Congress, and she's taken time out from her office, and she has to rush right back, making somebody else look good. Let's have another.
Riddle. Real, mean, a stitchin', any way you cut it, you're in it, up to your gills in it, you rise in it and sink, that great leveler, you kill it, live on borrowed talk and tick, once upon a it begins, and then goes by, as I will love you till the end of it.
Let's have another.
This is called Slough of the Seven Toads. The elation of naming, that dispassionate stance, of course it could not last. As all first steps, it was bound to lead to that first misstep, that attenuated fall through ebony branches into the forest of indifference. Oh, how to define the pain of it, the eclipse of sky, the scales that seem to sprout over her eyes, the petals of love lies bleeding, wilting in that thicket of night. Then a headlong plunge into the slough of the seven toads, and there, defiled by false iridescence, the barter, the intrigue, the back and forth, that rough exchange, the petty puffery of fame, the flat inspection of their malachite eyes.
That's the Barbara I knew first. She was the one with fairy tales, magic things that happened, myths made myths in forests with little elves and toads. And you used layers of story. And that is very much reminiscent of some of the work you did early with Berta Broadfoot.
Yes.
Cautionary Tales.
Right. I do feel that the Brothers Grimm is my motherland or homeland. And I just think that the characters I find very appealing, and the terror that they evoke is just a preparation for life itself. But luckily, there's the happy ending in the Grimms. So,
and your final poem is our happy ending, Barbara Goldberg.
Well, I'm not sure it's a happy ending. This is just something to think about. It's called Amulet. May the Lord of Death pass over this house. May the Lord of Envy not curdle our way. May the Lord of Greed release us from craving. Great Lord of Time, grant us a stay.
Amen. The voice of Barbara Goldberg. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. We're back. We're at the Library of Congress, Four Women Poets. Myung-hee Kim is here. She is very well known for her Korean translations, most notably that of Lee Sang. Myung-hee Kim was born in Seoul, Korea, and she studied philosophy at Korea University. In 1970, she moved to the United States and attended George Washington University, studying psychology and creative writing. She is making a great, great contribution, bringing Korean poets into English who have never before been heard. Here's the voice of Myung-hee Kim.
Poetry 1. After reading the history of American literature, I grew fond of Emily Dickinson, yet I know nothing about her personal details, such as how tall she was, the length of her hair, and how large her eyes were. And I don't know if she had a dark mole on her body. But once in a while, I write in my poems that she had a mole on her body, too. After song is sung, a phrase of warmth that came along with the song warms up the air on the earth. But the song never ends as a song. Afterwards, it turns into shadow of frightening silence, This is love of song and death of song.
Who is that written by?
This is written by a poet named Ogi Won, about whom I heard the news yesterday that he died February 2nd, and he was buried a couple of days ago.
Did he know you were translating him?
No, he wasn't. I was thinking, I was preparing for this appearance, and I was thinking that after this broadcast, thinking that I will send the copies of this translation to him. But
what a contribution, though, for the world that would never know him before. Let's hear another poem. And say his name one more time, because I think it's the first time the audience has ever heard this name.
His name's O-Q-1. Next poem is In Yongsan. There are old-fashioned people who still believe that the fanciful stories are bound in poetry. In poetry, there is nothing except our lives, which are not very fanciful, and the illusions of those who want to believe in fancy stories. As our foolishness grow, swaying our wills and ideas, your love, your belief, my fraud, and the surety of my fraudulency are not very clear as they seem to be. On the beautiful lawn, weeds are growing. How about loving the idea that nothing is certain? There's nothing in poetry except rest of our lives. We always encounter the rest of our lives, not nearly so fanciful. You may not want to believe it, but nothing nearly so fanciful.
Was that hard to translate?
It is. It is. Sometimes it is easy, sometimes it is hard.
Are you trying to get his essence? Is that the difficulty? The words will come, but are you trying to capture his spirit and say it as he would wish it to be said?
That's what I'm trying to do, and that's a part of thing that I have to go under the skin of the poetry and walk in there and see what's happening, feel what he's trying to do. And that's why I felt so sad yesterday when I heard about his death, that I was I felt that I knew him very intimately. But so when I heard about his death, I cried. Even though I never knew him, I never met him. I felt that
you probably know him better than the people who were one inch away from him. Oh. You probably know his spirit. That is a pretty blessed thing, to be a translator and to approach it the way you're doing. Let's have another of his poems. And you know what? I don't know what the Korean belief is in the afterlife. Maybe you could just tell me very quickly. Is there a belief in your cultural view of an afterlife? And if there is, can we hope that he's listening?
I hope so. But in Korean traditional culture, the soul, departed soul, be around in the world, around the vicinity of his house, in this world, about 49 days.
49?
You're right.
I know another cultural belief that says 3 days. So 49, I'll go with that one.
Yeah, then our soul will go up to the heaven, whatever.
Well, we'll be on air before 49 days, so we're covered.
Okay.
Let's have another poem. I might say her name again, Myung-hee Kim. She's a great contribution to Washington, D.C. as a Korean translator. She worked for the State Department in 1980 and then began writing poetry in English and Korean. And she published, I can't believe this, she worked on a translation of Allen Ginsberg's poems in Korean. I didn't think there was any Korean equivalency for some of his words. Did it work?
Yes, okay. Of course.
Oh,
it did.
I have to see those. Yeah. Here we are. Go ahead.
Words. To convince myself, I say I believe in my words. To be convinced about everything, I believe in words. The crickets that cry in the shadow of belief, the cow pacing in its pen of certainty, the darkness falls in between the beliefs. I don't dream. Instead, I chew on dreams. Until now, my words have failed to reveal the true shape of myself. And as this situation will continue, my belief is the belief I believe in. Even a false belief becomes a belief because I believe in it. When we believe words like flower, dreams, career, human as nouns, the flower, dream, career, and you, of course, as a human, are all happy. The people who want to be happy shall believe in something. You can trust these words because these are not the words of Jesus.
I love the line, cows pacing in the stalls of certainty. That's quite devastating.
It is.
And certainly the poet is not guilty of that. This is Myung-Hee Kim at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and she's been translating. Would you be able to read something in Korean for us? Because
yeah.
It sounds so beautiful. And then read the translation in English.
Okay.
That'll be good.
I will read from Korean.
What book is that?
This is the book, poetry book of Ogiwon, the poet I read. Poems in Korean is a si, we call it si. Yeah. So this is the si. 나는 미국 문학사를 읽은 후 지금까지 에밀리 디킨슨을 좋아하는데 좋아하는 그녀의 신장 머리칼의 길이, 눈의 크기, 그런 것은 하나도 모른다. 그녀의 몸에 까만 사마귀가 하나 있는지 없는지도 모른다. 그러나 나는 가끔 그녀의 몸에 까만 사마귀가 하나 있다고 시에 적는다. 노래가 끝나고 난 뒤에는 노래를 따라 나온 한 자락 따스한 마음이 이 지상의 기운을 태운다. 우리의 노래는 언제나 노래로 끝나지 못하고 노래가 끝난 다음에 무서운 침묵의 그림자가 된다. 그것이 노래의 사랑, 노래의 죽음이다.
Is that the one with the brown mole?
Yes.
Okay, which words are brown mole? So this poet had such a sense of humor. He said that he didn't know Emily Dickinson or her hair. You read that poem first.
Right.
But he did not know if she had a brown mole on her body, but he put it in the poem anyway. Which words are brown mole?
사마귀.
Terrific.
It's called 사마귀.
That is great. I love it. Now I know something I've never known before and nothing I will ever know like this. How brown mole on Emily Dickinson's body sounded in Korean. Myung-Hee Kim has been writing for a local Korean newspaper, and you're a weekly columnist.
Right.
What is a column? What does the column comprise? Is it news?
It's not news. I was writing about American Civil War stories, and it ended a couple years ago. And right now, from 2 years ago, I've been writing a column called "The Poems I Like." I sort of pick poems from Korean and Chinese. And American, obviously, I have to translate it into Korean. And I write about poems, sort of trying to see what is going on in the poem.
And this is all in Korean,
Korean
community.
Right.
Is that a large community in Washington?
Yeah. And I have quite a few fans on the articles.
Don't throw away your fan letters. because we can put them in the Gelman Special Collection.
Okay.
Because if you throw away your fan letters and you just save your hate mail, that's not good. So let's have another poem.
Okay.
Did you hear the Korean poet who wrote the book So What? It's a recent book, but it's getting quite a bit of...
Is that right?
In English, yeah.
Oh,
it's getting
know.
Quite a bit of press. So I'll have to share that.
I don't know. This one is about the Korean economic growth. Yeah, he's writing about what is happening in Korean humanity, people among this growing economy. A life under the sky. The construction of an apartment building is in progress. The clouds of dust rising. 1, 2, 6, 9, 12, 16, and on. While the crane pushes over the stone chunks, trucks, wood panels, and cement bags jostle me. Alone, the sun is shoved away from the shoulders of laborers climbing up and down the 15-stair height. In a corner of the construction site, under a large wooden panel, there a lone pansy grows like a legend. Along with the spurned sun stands the lonely pansy flower looking at me.
The voice of Myung Hee Kim. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're celebrating women poets. We're back at the Library of Congress with poets celebrating poetry. Sibby O'Sullivan is with us, and I met her first on a CD that she produced of her poetry and other people reading it, and she's all about voice. Here's Sibby.
The widows go to water aerobics. We begin with the shoes which have names like oracle, power, courage. Next, the brassieres releasing their perfumed guests, a downward roll of waistbands, socks, a second's nakedness. Then the upward strapping in, wiggle and hoist, buttocks to colorful cups, the adjusted cleft. At pool's edge, fears mimic, toes boggle the ladder. Inch by inch, our stomachs lowered like ordnance into the water. And then we are launched, a flotilla of cleavage and hairnets, arms held akimbo by miracle bagels, styrofoam dumbbells at 20 a pop. We're told to resist, to turn and cross country and make the butt burn, to pump our flesh into flume, to scissor and scum, and finally to come to rest, to bat down the bubbles and come to rest. How long have we been suspended? How long will we dangle before we unhook and follow the heel, then the heart down to the husbands castled below? Such tender reunion. They see us upwards, a kind of prophecy, shipwreck from another world, and for a moment we are younger, lighter, held in our zeros, girdled by foam. But too soon the instructor, waving us out of our azure forgetting, come back is the call, come back, its deep echo following us as we slush toward the dry weight of time, the ladder's cold staircase, our silver reversals, as water to air, we climb out of one grave and into another, the groove of our straps trenched in our shoulders, their kisses still stinging our heels.
Sibby O'Sullivan, only a poet could immortalize Water aerobics. The voice. You must have been a singer.
I do like to sing, and I like to hear people sing and think of poetry as a form of singing. So I'm very attached to voices.
Also a theater person.
I have written some plays, yes, and that's been lots of fun, too.
But the voice is something you not only demonstrate, but make possible for other people to read. And the voice in your work is very, very strong point of view in every one of your poems. So you are all about voice, as I say.
I think it's very important to have that in poetry, because it's an oral art.
If ever there were a narrative and a lyrical poet together, your work is it. So I want to go on.
Okay. This one does tell a story. I like to have kind of quirky truths in my poems. This is called Good and Plenty. During that masterpiece of Will, A Man for All Seasons, my father shuffled up the dark aisle to satisfy his bladder and my sweet tooth. He was gone ages. Heads would roll. And when he returned with nothing but a crappy box of snow caps, he whispered, "They're all out of Fine and Dandy." Fine and Dandy could be horses' names. Reversed, Dandy and Fine, you get a law firm. Tiny pastel toes rattling in their box. Plenty good. Indian talk for pure sugar and a mild laxative. Down the hatch they go. What a dump. That's Betty Davis, Daddy's favorite. Mom like Robert Taylor. I like Richard Burton, how he'd puke out murder and dance evil like it has six syllables. Maybe heaven's a huge screen, something like the sky with John Wayne flying through it. Maybe God is Orson Welles waddling off the bridge in a touch of evil. And though my parents knew beauty when my sister was born, it was our uncle, nerved with a few bolts of champagne, who gave her legs. Marlene, Marlena, she's alive, and she really does have horses, and likes real licorice, too, the kind that looks like cut-up tires and used to come in waxy bags. Who sat behind that counter, fly-deep with dust, and sold Daddy those snow caps? Some pimpled twit, I bet, or perhaps a dipso widow with finned blue hair. Do they remember him? The man who lumbered up, then lumbered down again, then whispered to his daughter's ungrateful ear that catastrophe of syllables. I remember Susanna York taking down Paul Schofield's head, and though this is off screen, I also see her press it to her heart.
Sibby O'Sullivan. She has a PhD in American literature from the University of Maryland, and her academic specialties include the history of American masculinity, the body in literature, and narrative theory, which we are actually hearing put into practice.
I want to hear more. I love words and reading, and I hope to communicate that to my students. But I love men and the body better.
Well, do we have any evidence of that?
Well,
perhaps you could just tell us, just for a moment, how that research went.
The research into men and bodies? Well, my dissertation was about a rereading of Hemingway in terms of images of masculinity. And that got me thinking overall about the history of American masculinity. And so I studied that. And out of my work with Hemingway, I developed a course that I've been teaching for a number of years.
Is that dissertation published?
No, it's not.
Has to be.
Okay.
Has to be published. That
I
want to read it. I don't know.
It's a good dissertation. It broke some ground. That was back in 1986. Nowadays, everybody talks about all the gender bending going on in Hemingway and how people had misread him. But back in 86, I was struggling up a hill.
Here she is, Sibby O'Sullivan.
Earlier, Grace, you said about the voice. And one thing that happens to me is I do a lot of reading, and I'm the kind of reader that reads out loud. I move my lips. I actually do read out loud, and I want to hear a voice in literature. And sometimes when I hear that, then that creates voices in me. And so then I can kind of write off of that energy, both from the literature and also from my own hearing of voices and then creating voices. So in this poem, this is about a voice coming back from the dead, something that I believe happens. It's called Ghost Talk. You wonder, how am I? It's hard to say. Think of the ghost in Hamlet, old, bearded, royally pissed, appearing only, what, 3 times in Shakespeare's longest play? No matter. I'm new to the thing. So I've answered you by telling you to think of a ghost, a literary ghost. But that's what I was those final years, shreds and patches. I'm still that, but also something else, a kind of crud on the castle wall, time's smegma. Talk hurts, but what else is there? Every night your heart unwraps its bandage, language spills out. Language, watch it waddle. I once watched you waddle down the hallway of my house, a tray of pills in one hand, a penthouse in the other. I knew you loved me, and then less so. It was the same for me. I grew tired of everything. Your mother's here, her ballet legs and tear-filled breasts. Datums, yours and mine, the whole world's actually dad's infinitum. See, I've kept in character. My Mary? She still tries to shush me with a soft elbow into whatever I've become. A wife's privilege, I suppose. We've been remired, reunioned. And though she's the best thing about this place, nothing fastens like it used to. They always laugh at him, you know, the ghost, trapdoor Teddy, clanking up from the cellar, walking through walls, spoiler of banquets and uninvited guests with a bad case of gas and too much on his mind and little time to say it all. For what, the critics ask? Revenge, remarriage, reminding? Those are questions for the living. Our need is simpler. To be unlonely for the human tense, to speak in words again. There are some who manage this, and they're the lucky ones, but I'm not one of them. When I lean out into the larger night, I can still see things. I see you gauzed in your computer's glow, your synapses solvent with memory sugar. I see bells, baskets, goo for your shower, the book face down beneath your reading lamp. You turn and I hear your questions. Purgatory? The pain of stones. Eternity? A hand's width. Quintessence of dust? Not even close. I'm fixed in a kind of quantum amber, far past science or imagining. The invisible event. Don't let me end. Make pins of me. Keep me between your lips, a future kiss, a night wound syllable, a word you underline and then repeat.
Oh, Sibby. Has that been published?
No, I keep trying.
That is, I don't know how you wrote it.
Well, I had a little bit of help with Shakespeare. I had been rereading Hamlet, and I love Shakespeare's language, and there were so many interesting phrases and images and meanings in that poem. And a kind of miraculous thing happened that I was reading Hamlet, and just suddenly this other voice came in, the voice of a dead lover who was an English professor, who was sort of a rascal at times and unhappy at other times, but a great, great lover of language. And I just said, okay, I'm going to do the postmodern thing, and I'm going to take this voice and I'm going to use some metaphysical conceits and some words from Shakespeare himself. So there's a little bit of the bard in this.
And the delivery, I think you were more than generous to allow seven different readers to read Little Wheel, because I think the next CD has to be Sibby O'Sullivan from beginning to end. And now we're going to end with a final poem.
Yes. This poem is called Faith. The world's small kisses are everywhere. The river's raveled light. The advertisements lifting in the air their sordid names, accepting any weather. These are kisses of color. Or outside the train window, coming back from New York, the orange wasp of light humming near the oil drums. When I was young, I used to press my knuckles to my eyes, a childhood game to bring on sleep. Black would spin to purple, red to green. Once, far inside a corridor of brain, a simple golden spangled tree appeared. This is the garden, I thought, then off to sleep. At night, planes drift past my house like tiny flashlights. Far below, the river drags its dirty slip of ice. The whole world is moving, but I am fixed, a dark magnet of blood listening for the hidden diligence of water, its bottomless breathing. My daughter sleeps. I bend to kiss her cheek, but she is far away, the kiss a snowflake melting in the air. I smooth her hair back from her face, or smooth the air between her face and mine. She does not know I come to do these things, the small, blank kindnesses of sleep.
The unforgettable voice of Sibby O'Sullivan. We're at the Library of Congress. We're celebrating 30 years on air with my favorite poets. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're back at the Library of Congress, and we're featuring Kathy Wolf. Here's Kathy.
Love and kumquats. Even blind girls get the blues. I tell my mother when she wonders why I expect to go to the senior prom when no one would ask someone like me, and why I can't be happy spending Saturday evenings curled up with a large print book. In southern New Jersey with no wheels, I'm hermetically sealed in the Pine Barrens. At a gay bar on Christopher Street, vamping like Tallulah on a tear, I'm checking out the red-haired woman who surely will be the next love of my life. I love Helen Keller, she says, but what are you doing in a place like this? In Cleveland, full of love and kumquats, we leave our favorite Chinese place. You should watch her. She might fall, a prune-faced woman growls. I do, and I enjoy it, you whisper.
Kathy Wolf, who takes the tragedies of the world and makes us love them and makes us laugh and cry so much. Kathy, I know you're writing about Helen Keller. It will be your first published book. And you're making big sparkles all over the place as a reviewer online. You have a mission in life, and it's not only to make people laugh. And I think we got a taste of it there. What is it?
What I'm trying to do is to help people get inside the skin of folks with disabilities, folks who are gay, folks who are different, and to hear our stories.
And you said you have been writing up a little bit, which I hope becomes memoir. It started out as a letter to me on email, and it said that when you were young, you thought you'd never live to be an adult because all you saw of disabled people was on television, on telethons. You didn't know they really existed, and they were always kids, and you never saw anyone on television or any image that let you see back what productive people could do.
Right. I never saw folks who looked like me. Generally, the only blind or disabled people I saw were either sick kids and the only adults I ever saw, well, first of all, that's all I saw till I was 10, and then my parents finally found a woman who was in her 30s and who was blind, and I met her, and I was like, wow, you're alive, because 30's old when you were a kid.
Well, I think the best example we have of this is in your own work. So let's go on. Kathy Wolfe at the Library of Congress.
This is a poem about Helen Keller, and it's called Lunch at the Algonquin. Thank God for vodka and caviar. They're an antidote to condescension, Helen thinks. An actress, a Park Avenue socialite, and a celebrity columnist blanket her in their awe. Once again, she is the eighth wonder of the world. Annie, her teacher, spells out their bromides letter by letter into Helen's reluctant hands. You're so amazing, intones the starlet. Do you really know how to eat? I went to Radcliffe and learned Greek as well as the Harvard boys. I believe I can manage a salad fork. She'd like to tell this half-baked floozy. But the ladies who lunch frown on sarcastic deaf-blind saints. Still, against all her good breeding, her naked life force comes alive, taking her fingers out of Annie's hand, away from the flowing fountain of pity, Helen burps.
Did you do that, or did Helen do that?
Probably both of us have burped at one time.
Continue, Kathy Wolfe.
Helen, when she was 36, fell in love with a man named Peter Fagan. Her family nixed the marriage. This is in 1916. At this point in her life, she had been a lecturer, a vaudeville star, but much like folks today who are gay, can't get married, she faced the same dilemma. And she also loved junk food. She loved hot dogs so much. Inhaling their sweat, licking their salt, was like kissing Peter on the night train, as if only their tangy passion mattered. Before her teacher's protestations, her mother's remonstrations, her brother's gun-waving against her deaf-blind, mouth-watering love, ended their ride to what she'd always wanted, not fame or riches, but the salted, happily ever after, where kisses taste like mustard, embraces char on the grill, and love, like onions, makes the eyes water.
I know that you have entered her psychosis. You have entered her eros. You have entered her skin. And what, in one sentence, could you say about Helen Keller?
She lived, she got angry, she loved, she thought, she wrote, she prayed.
And here's another poem.
This one is what I call a me poem, in that it could be Helen, but not necessarily. Yellow tulips. When I'm sweaty like cotton candy in the seventh inning stretch of the final game of the World Series, out of tune like a piano, too drunk to debut in Carnegie Hall, empty as a soothsayer with no truth, frightened as glass, afraid to shadow. When the dead yellow tulips remind me that we will all turn to dust, I think of you playing with my hair 3 weeks before you died. The soft white clouds, you said, will always be there. Not much comfort, but enough.
That is an autobiographical poem, but it's universal as well. And are we going to hear some more Helen?
I didn't bring any more Helen.
Oh, I'm going to hear some Kathy.
What I think I'll read to you, the kind of glass ceiling that folks with disabilities live through, it was there for Helen, but it's still there for us today. And this poem, in a way, speaks about that. And I should tell you just before that I read it that I hate bugs. And you'll see after I read it why I said that. Metamorphosis on the Boston shuttle. You probably don't think twice about underwear when you fly. I never did. Until one morning my seatmate touches my white cane, pats my head, and exclaims, "Wow, you're sitting all by yourself." She talks loudly, slowly, with a big smile on her voice, like a mother talking to a deaf 2-year-old. You've found the seatbelt. You have a purse. I dream I'm in a tropical paradise where birds, not blind people, are exotic. Your clothes are clean. How do you wash your underwear? I dream I'm a fly. Life will be short, but the underwear question won't be asked. I dream I'm the world's first blind entomologist. My ears pick up sounds sight an entomologist can't hear. The faint but acute whine of the blue sequoia. The subtle but poignant sigh of the yellow centipede. I teach the long-legged bugs how to dance. They do not wear underwear.
At some point, when people think they're caring, they're really being extremely insulting. And it's that fine line where you take it and make it a story that we can accept. It's not too hard to hear.
Yeah, I'm trying to make it to be poetry and fun and engaging. I don't want it to be eat your spinach. Not that I'm dissing spinach.
Kathy Wolf, everything she says, I want to hear. We're at the library. Go ahead.
Okay. This is a retelling of the Three Blind Mice story. Dancing in the dark came naturally to the three blind mice. Hours and hours, day after day, learning to move one foot ahead of the other in a darkened world at the school for sightless mice, gave them confidence, grace. They read in a box at the opera, listened to Mozart on CDs, invited friends to backyard barbecues. Their sense of taste so sharp, the literati sought their advice on wine and cheese. Still the memories lurched in the pits of their stomachs, running all night after the farmer's wife through unkept fields, blisters on their pink and white feet, the last image fading from their retinas, shadows of hungry cats, the slice of that knife cutting off their tails, almost beheading their souls, bandages, hospitals, spitting in the eye of the blindness god, until one day, without their consent, hope grew like a dandelion in their hearts.
Oh, I love it. I love it. All that running after the farmer's wife, but there is a happy ending. Kathy Wolf, don't stop.
This is a Helen Keller poem. Helen speaking. Ashes, Rome, 1946. Soot bombards my hair. Soldiers blinded in battle tell rough-edged jokes to hide their tears. If only I could conjure spells, I caress their faces. My hands smolder. The braille dots smell like acrid socks. Your home in Connecticut is gone. It went up in smoke. Everything lost except the silver, a friend writes. The dining room chairs, Japanese vases, the dog's water dish, my manuscripts turn to ashes. I wipe sweat off foreheads of wounded vets, brush dust from my wrinkled dress, and write, in the beginning was the word, the potion against self-pity.
And here's another poem.
This poem is, the title comes from a line from the humorist E.B. White. Lying here in these fierce pajamas, I'm stage struck when you glide like Grace Kelly checking out the murder scene without wrinkling her latest dress from Paris through the rear window of my champagne-soaked dreams. I don't want to be snowed under by the inelegant ice of January, the reams of paper prancing on my desk, the news of war pounding like a wordworm in my head. I want to dance with you in our Cole Porter world, where anything goes except disaster, and the common currency is laughter. You remind me, that was another movie. We're not dressed for it now.
We're at the Library of Congress, and we're going to have a final poem. Kathy Wolf is a poet who lives in Falls Church, Virginia, and she has written for The Washington Post, The Washington Blade. Her poetry has appeared in many magazines like Gargoyle, The Potomac Review, Beltway Poetry Quarterly. She's read at Washington, D.C.'s poetry reading series, including the Library of Congress Poetry at Noon. And she has received grants for poetry residencies. She teaches blind children, and she teaches them to write poetry. Here's a final poem.
Annie is buried, and this is Helen Keller speaking in the poem. Annie is buried November 3rd, 1936, National Cathedral, Washington, D.C. Raised by spit-stained drunks in a rat-infested poorhouse, you would love the high ceilings, stained glass windows, orderly rows of pews, the scaffolding of this place. I'm not your handmaiden, you spelled into my hands, fingertips shaking with fury when a banker wanted my autograph. A young girl cut off a lock of my hair at a party many years ago. It was as if you were invisible. Today, politicians, actresses praise you. A blind girl brings roses to the altar. A newsboy wipes his eyes. You have no love for the church. Yet you'd be so pleased when the bishop says you're among the greatest teachers of all time. You taught me words, fishing me out of my sea of unnamed horrors. You turned deafness and blindness into strong but playful monsters. You did not teach me how to say goodbye to you.
Oh, a testament, a love letter, a statement. A political statement from Kathy Wolfe. That was her voice, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. Associate producer is Ken Flynn. We wish to thank the Library of Congress. Our series is funded by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry with assistance from the WordWorks, presenting poetry programs in Washington, D.C. since 1975. Our engineer is Brad McCoy. I'm Grace Cavalieri.